Welcome to Hub Dialogues, a podcast that celebrates the big thinkers and bold ideas that are driving the public conversation. On Hub Dialogues, you'll hear the Hub's editor-at-large, Sean Spear, in conversation with some of the world's sharpest minds and brightest thinkers about the issues and ideas that they're passionate about and that they think we should spend more time focusing on. The Hub's podcasts are generously supported by listeners like you. Visit thehub.ca to enroll now as a free member. Members get access to the Hub's best content and analysis, including original news reporting, commentary, and yes, lots more podcasting. Visit now, www.thehub.ca.
Welcome to Hub Dialogues. I'm your host, Sean Spear, editor-at-large at The Hub. I'm honored to be joined today by Ido Moid, Israel's ambassador to Canada. He was appointed to his current role in August 2023 and previously served in various others in Israel's foreign service, including as its cybersecurity coordinator and at posts in Singapore, The Hague, and Beijing. I'm grateful to speak with him today about Iran's drone and missile attack over the weekend and Israel's possible response, his country's ongoing campaign to defeat Hamas, and his experience in Canada over the past 8 months or so, including scenes of anti-Semitism in some parts of our society. Ambassador Moid, thanks for joining us at Hub Dialogues.
Thank you, Sean, for having me.
I have to start with this weekend's attacks launched from Iran. Talk about the magnitude of the attacks and the level of threat of destruction and harm that they represented.
Basically, Iran launched several hundreds of airborne munitions from Iran, be it missiles, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and UAVs. Some of them were launched from the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, from Yemen, some from Iraq, also missiles coming in from Lebanon. So multiplicity of sources, and at the same time orchestrated all from Tehran with the very clear aim to inflict as much as possible harm and damage on Israel, notably also almost hitting the Dome of the Rock, which is the third most holy places for Muslims around the world, and fortunately saved by Iron Dome, which was actually manufactured by Israel to protect whatever is on Israeli soil. So that, of course, includes also the Dome of the Rock.
Sir, I'll ask in a minute about Israel's extraordinary defense against the attack, but permit me to follow up, Ambassador, because there's a narrative circulating in the media and elsewhere that Iran's attack represented a token strike. That is, it wasn't really designed to do damage. Why is that narrative wrong?
Well, I'm not the one to analyze the Iranian intents, but our very clear understanding of what transpired here is that Iran is not only talking the talk, but is also physically attacking Israel and is very serious when it comes to annihilating the state of Israel. So when they use their ballistic missile arsenal, and when we know that they are devising nuclear weapons, we know how dangerous this regime is. And again, it's about the regime. It's not about the Iranian people, of course. So Iran is very serious, and it's devised a sort of a network of proxies, not just to eliminate the state of Israel, but because they have a much broader agenda in the Middle East when it comes to Shia-Sunni conflict. And so other countries in the region join Israel, not just because they want to avoid war, but also because they see their own interests.
Now, as you say, Israel and its allies were able to effectively block or destroy something like 99% of Iranian drones and missiles. Talk about what went into such a successful defense and how it played out, including the role of emerging allies such as Jordan and Saudi Arabia.
So I want to say a few words about the system itself, and then I'll get to your question, the other part about the region. Somewhere in the 90s, some very smart Israeli scientists came together when they realized after the war, the first Gulf War, and missiles were shot from Iraq into Israel, that at some point in time, this may become a serious threat to the country. And so we would need to have some kind of a defense system. It was almost inconceivable to think that it's possible to shoot down incoming missiles. Just imagine this incredible feat of, you know, missiles flying out of the atmosphere, hundreds of kilometers into the air, and then meeting them head to head and not exploding, just hitting them physically so that they'll be destroyed, which is just unimaginable. So what we have today is a four-layer system that is able to either mitigate threats coming in from outer space, those ballistic missiles. Then there is another level, which is just inside the atmosphere. Then there are two other levels, which are much closer to ground. So they will meet, we'll be able to mitigate, let's say, middle-range missiles and also, of course, the rockets and mortar and so on, the short range. So it's a multi-layer system just to shoot down all those missiles. But on top of that, we have the Air Force, which is able to shoot down the UAVs. And we have also other systems put in place, like electronic warfare and so on, that will disrupt the launch of those missiles in the first place. So it's a very broad and thick layer of defense. And on top of that, as you just mentioned, and that is extremely important, that's the region. So we have our allies that also see the importance of trying to avoid further escalation and that have also self-interest. And of course, also believe in international law and that attacking Israel is actually in contradiction to the international law, and they will not allow their airspace to be abused for any kind of missiles. And they also say if Israel would use their airspace in such a way, they would not allow it to attack another country. So there you have it, a very broad and effective system that was able to mitigate 99% of all those incoming missiles.
It's an extraordinary feat, Ambassador, and I know the Hub community congratulates all Israelis and its partners in avoiding, as you say earlier, could have been quite a serious and damaging assault. The natural question on the top of people's minds, of course, is Israel's response to these attacks. Are you able to cast any light on the thinking within Israel's government about how and when to respond?
First of all, we've said very clearly that whoever hits Israel, we will hit them back. I mean, that's just a principled position, of course. We cannot lose a war. Israel cannot afford to lose a war. We are small, we are tiny, and so we cannot afford that. And so when anybody attacks us, we have to do whatever we can to make sure that they will never do it again or think long and hard before they, you know, even contemplate anything. We have said that we will react, and Israel will react, but we will find a time and place to do it. The Israeli cabinet is deliberating on it. We're also in contact with our international partners on it. But it is extremely important to make sure that there is a response. In our neighborhood, in the Middle East, it's another kind of a neighborhood, which is filled with thugs. Sometimes they have very friendly partners, and we find very quickly common grounds and common language among the Arab countries, of course, but also at some points you have to hit them, and you have to hit them hard in the face to make the, to make sure that they don't even contemplate again putting this kind of a barrage or anything at Israel. Israel has a right to exist. Israel has a right to defend itself, and Israel will do that at, to its best of its ability. This is the responsibility of the government vis-a-vis its civilians, and this is exactly what Israel will do. Israelis also support this government to the fullest, even if we have our internal issues about politics and so on. But the overall majority of the population, Jews and non-Jews, by the way, supports this government because it is about our existence. And it's very notable to see that during this war with Hamas, which is already has been going on for 6 months, you know, we have in Israel, we have about 20% of our population are Arabs, are not Jews. And they are part and parcel of the whole society coming together to protect the country. They are the doctors, they are the surgeons, they are the judges in courts, they are the pharmacists, they are everywhere and anywhere. And they completely adopt the sense that this is their choice. They don't want Hamas. They have family in Gaza. They have, their heart is bleeding for the population there. And they say that. And they have a lot of issues with how the government may handle itself and maybe regarding humanitarian aid or whatever. But they're also the ambulance drivers who went into fire into Re'im, Kibbutz Re'im, during that festival to save people from the line of fire, because they believed that they, as Israelis, had the duty to save other Israelis. And that sort of solidarity, I think not many of our listeners would understand that it is between Jews and non-Jews. And it is a common interest that we have to save this country and to make this country to what it is, a free, vibrant democracy where there are a lot of political differences, but there is very clear understanding of solidarity when it comes to the very existence of this state.
I want to transition now, Ambassador, from the Iranian attacks over the weekend to the October 7th attacks and Israel's subsequent military campaign and Gaza. It seems to me that the Iranian attacks have demonstrated once again the extent to which it was always wrong to view October 7th as merely a Hamas-led attack, and instead was something coordinated and supported by the Iranian regime. How key is it for those in Canada and elsewhere to understand October 7th as Iranian-backed terrorism? And why do you think this dimension is often neglected by Western news media and policymakers?
That's a very good question, because it brings us to the issue of what is really taking place right now in the Middle East. It is not just a terrorist attack. We've had many of those. This is a war that is instigated by an entity that is almost equivalent to a state. Hamas has been able to magnify their power position in Gaza, which Israel left, by the way. There was no occupation in Gaza since 2005. To become a real state, they have managed, with support of Iran, to build a full-fledged army, which was equipped, trained, and supported intelligence-wise, technically-wise, and many other ways by Iran. So without Iran, Hamas would not have been what it is. Without Iran, Hezbollah has not been able to sit on the northern border of Israel with 150,000 precision-guided missiles aimed at all over Israel. Without Iran, the Houthis were not able to thwart international trade routes that flows through the Suez Canal, the Red Sea. So Iran is a major player, and Israel has been calling out Iran for many years, not just for its nuclear program, which is extremely dangerous and still can be stopped, but also because of their intent to change the Middle East and to further pursue what they call the Islamic Revolution. And this agenda has not been neglected, and it is very dangerous. And the fact that Iran has been able to find partners in other powers in the world is danger in itself, but it has to make us understand that this Hamas-Israel war is just one symptom of a much broader issue. Iran is like an octopus with various tentacles, and it has to be addressed as such. This is the head. This is where it all originates from. It's the Iranian Ayatollah regime which has this, pursues this agenda. And so when Iran chairs the Human Rights Council, which is an absurd, but happens, it just happens now, we in the world should be walking out of the room and not trying to accept that as a fact just because that's how our international system works. Our international system works to support those who adhere to the rules of the international system. And Iran is not such a country. It actually abuses that system in order for it to pursue this revolutionary agenda, which is extremely deadly and dangerous. And it will not end with Israel. It will go further. Let's say that Israel is Iran's only adversary. Why would Iran need then a missile program which has a reach of full of Europe? Why would Iran need to aim anything at Europe? It's certainly not at Russia, and there's nothing to the south, and it's not aiming at China, so there's only Europe. So we have to understand that Iran is a very serious threat.
Ambassador, I said I was going to transition the conversation, but if you'll permit me one follow-up, what do you think the strategic and symbolic significance is these attacks were launched directly from Tehran and not through proxies, as has been the case in the past?
That is the next step for Iran, to go further beyond its hiding behind proxies. Until now, they've been fighting to the last proxy. Now they've taken matters to their own hands. I think it's because they understand that their plan to try to disrupt the Middle East and to destroy the developing relations between Israel and Sunni countries around it were not developing according to their plans, to the way they intended it to be. So they took the matters to their own hands, and they want to try and drive a wedge between us and our neighbors. It doesn't work. To the contrary, our neighbors come to our help. So who knows what's next, but it's definitely important at this point in time to deter Iran from further escalating. And in our eyes, that means also using force against Iran so that it understands what it means when it uses force to such an extent. But I want to bring this a little bit closer to home and talk about what can be done here. And I think that the first step should be the designation of the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization. That has to happen immediately. I know it's been discussed in the past. I know it was sort of a partisan issue, but it's a bipartisan issue. It's an all-party issue because Iran is a threat to this country as much as anything else. And so that should be a first step, along with sanctions that need to be put in place so that the missile industry, the drone industry are all hampered in their effort to further develop more weapons and to inflict more harm.
Hi, Hub Podcast listeners. Rudyard Griffiths here, the publisher of The Hub, with a special announcement. Over the coming weeks on our publishing platform, including this podcast feed, we are going to be bringing attention to the growing government subsidization of news journalism in Canada. It will be possible this year for many digital news outlets to access government funding for up to 50% of the salaries of their journalists. We think this is a problem. Public trust in the media is already at all-time lows. More government subsidies doesn't make this any better. In fact, government subsidies raise questions, legitimate ones, for listeners and news consumers like you. Can you trust news organizations that are taking large government supports to underwrite the cost of their journalism? Will they hold the powerful, including government, to account? Here at The Hub, we do not take government funding. We made this decision because we think it's important to our independence, to our credibility with you, our listeners and readers. Creating news and original content is expensive, time-consuming, and depends on people like you becoming paid subscribers. You can do that right now on our website, www.thehub.ca. Thank you in advance for your generous support. Now let's get back to our program.
I listened to a Q&A in Ottawa last week with former Israeli Prime Minister Bennett, who reiterated that Israel's overriding objective remains to destroy Hamas. Talk about progress towards that objective, and if you still believe that it's ultimately possible.
Hamas, as a proxy of Iran and as a terrorist organization in itself, has managed to catch us by surprise and to inflict horrific damage and killing 1,200 people, taking hundreds of them hostage and still keeping 133 of them in tunnels underneath Gaza. For us, and again, for the overall majority of the Israeli population, it's very clear that Hamas must be defeated because we know their covenant is, that's where from the river to the sea comes from the river Jordan to the Mediterranean Sea, there will be just one state, and that will not be Israel. And so for us, it's very clear that Hamas, having still four battalions, operative battalions active in the southern part of Gaza, in Rafah, means that we still have to pursue our fight against them. Their military capability still exists. They are still firing rockets. I don't know how many of our listeners know that, but as we speak, they are still firing rockets into Israel. The fact that they hold 133 hostages and are actually sabotaging the negotiations means that they have no intention of releasing them. I think that most of the interlocutors already given up hope with Hamas to get a deal done with them. So it is very clear for Israelis that we have to move on with this war against Hamas. When people say you cannot defeat an idea, I may agree when it comes to a sort of an idealism. But what Hamas is driving is the full destruction of the state of Israel. And I think that many people, even those who are marching and joining those hate marches on the streets here in Canada not always realize what they are supporting. It is not against the Palestinian people. It is against a deadly genocidal organization that has only one intent, and that is to kill all Jews. I don't think that many people understand that. I don't think that many people understand that the keffiyeh actually symbolizes a one-state solution where Israel has no room and no place. So when it comes to the future of the region, we first and foremost have to make sure that Hamas has no role there. The Canadian government has said that, but it's not enough to say it. We have to fight them, and we have to make sure that their capabilities are destroyed and that they don't play any more role of any to any effect, not in Gaza, and not in the West Bank. And having said that, we also have to think about something else, and that is the mindset among many Palestinians. Nowadays, still many Palestinians believe that what Hamas did was the right thing. They believe that Israel does not have a right to exist. The fact that UNRWA, as a refugee relief organization, still exists and actually perpetuates the status of refugees is something that has to make people aware of the fact that there is an ongoing effort to annihilate the state of Israel. And that's unacceptable to us.
It's clear that Israel has faced some resistance from its allies to the ongoing campaign in Gaza, and even, according to reports, to responding to Iran's dangerous air attacks. The Canadian Parliament's motion in favor of, amongst other things, cutting weapons supplies to Israel is one such example. Let me ask you, Ambassador, how does Israel's government balance its relationships with traditional partners and ultimately do what's right for the interests of its own citizens? And how have you personally sought to strike that balance in your own role?
One of the hardest things for me as ambassador, I think, is to translate our reality in the Middle East and to portray a picture that people here in Canada can understand and can relate to. So when we are talking about distances, for example, and the fact that the Gaza Strip, the distance between the Gaza Strip and the kibbutzim next door are just as the from Gatineau to Ottawa, that may help. I think if we're talking about the size of Israel, which is like the St. Edward's Island, that's sometimes something that may help. But the point of the matter is that we are coping with a mindset that is destructive. And this is what's the hardest for people to comprehend, that there is an entity or there are people who believe that others have no right to live. And this is, I think, this is the hardest part for me as ambassador to try to translate that. When there is a motion in parliament that is there to recognize a Palestinian state, and I'm voicing my opinion that this is not the right time because it will be a reward for Hamas, it will be a reward for a massacre of 1,200 people. Well, I think people can relate to that, that at the end of the day, indeed, that part didn't get through. But at the other end, we have this kind of an arms ban or something unclear where we need more clarity, and we need it now because we're in the midst of a war and we are fighting against not only Hamas, not only against Hezbollah, but against Iran. This is an existential threat to Israel. This is what we need to have more clarity about. And this is another hard part of me being ambassador, conveying that message that these kind of issues, whatever reservation, whatever criticism there is, we need to be able to understand that there is reality. And our reality is that we are fighting for our lives. And this is not the time to create any burdens that will make our defense more complicated and more difficult at this time.
I want to return to the weekend's extraordinary display of defense technology and what it says about a subject that you're highly familiar with, which is Israeli innovation. As Canada and Israel grapple with concerns about economic growth, national security, and broader defense issues, is there an opportunity for greater bilateral partnerships? And how much of that is animating your work as ambassador?
That's something that I think I would like to be much more involved with that, because in my background as a cybersecurity coordinator at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, I was very much in touch with Israeli technology and know-how. And I found when I came here to Canada complementarity in many ways. But let me just talk a little bit about the Israeli model and explain to you and our listeners why I think it's so complementary to what is going on here in Canada. So first and foremost, we are working out of need. Israel is a small country, as I mentioned earlier. We don't have a lot of resources. We had a lack of water. And we knew that we have to rely on our know-how in order for us to find solutions. So we created solutions for the water industry. We created solutions for the military industry. How do we do that? By creating a sort of an ecosystem. And I think the key word for us in Israel is that we have a vertical and a horizontal ecosystem. So horizontally means that you have the government, you have the private sector, and you have the academia working in sync so that they understand what it means to devise technologies that can be applicable quickly, that will really solve problems. It's not just about making money. It's about solving existential problems like water, like cybersecurity, like anything else. So that would be the horizontal ecosystem. The vertical one would be if you take a young person and you go through his cycle of life and you see that he grows up in a high school where he would get a normal curriculum, but if he's interested and inclined to technology, he would get extra boost outside curricular hours. He would then join the military, which is compulsory in Israel. And in the military, he would be selected to those elite units that deal with technology because he was already encouraged during high school to expand his capacity, knowledge, and so on, and skills. Then he would get a three-year-long hands-on training, which is not just simply implementing technology, but actually challenges him on a daily basis with the most complicated problems. So he will need to find a solution for something. And he would think, well, I will need 2 months for that. And they'll tell him, fine, you'll have 2 days. We need the solution in 2 days. And so you have to think out of the box. You have to team up with people outside your immediate domain. You have to get out of your comfort zone. That's the most important thing. And you have to believe in yourself. You have to believe that you're capable of doing things that you think you can. Having spent those 3 years, you go to university and you come in with a lot of experience, and you come into an environment where research and the industry is already involved. So you become a student. As a student, you're not only learning, you're giving back. You're going to the high school where you got that support and nurturing from extracurricular studies. And then you go to the market. Then when you graduate, so you go through a cycle of experiences and understanding the different perspectives, both as a consumer, as government, and somebody who is probably entering the private sector. And so whatever solution you may come up with will be quickly, easily adopted. And so you see a lot of spin-offs from military technologies that enter into the civilian domain, be it Waze, be it the production of all kinds of applications that are used on a daily basis, and also sometimes the production of hardware that is important for our defense. So it could be precision-guided missiles, but it could be also drones that help us manage traffic, and it could be also medical supplies that help save lives, which is, as you may know, during this war, we broke several records in saving soldiers' lives, not just because we were able to evacuate them within an hour to the operation room, but also because we use all kinds of sophisticated technologies to help save their lives. So this kind of ecosystem that we have, I think, will work very well with the Canadian scaling capabilities, with a high level of technology here in Canada, with a very motivated crowd of students and scholars that are very much eager to learn and to give us in Israel different perspectives of what we know. Of course, we know only based on our own experiences, but we need to broaden that in order for us to be able to produce something that's valuable for other parts of the world. So I would see as many as cooperations between Israeli and Canadian counterparts on all three levels of this horizontal ecosystem. And I would expect them to culminate into what I would call centers of excellence. So there will be knowledge bases that can be used either for both our countries to enter the U.S. market or for bilateral, for global use. There is a lot that we can do, by the way, together in Africa, which is a continent that for most of us is something that we usually forget. But I've been dealing with Africa the last few years, and it's the fastest growing continent. It holds 40% of the global riches. And it's, it's just an incredible place. So many young people are very eager to develop and to get access to technologies and knowledge that both of our countries can share with them. So we can work magic together in my eyes, but we need the time and we need the capacity to do it. And that is something that I'm definitely working on as we speak. We are looking forward to have a hackathon within a few weeks that will deal with anti-Semitism and trying to mitigate that kind of harmful content and instead of it provide positive content. And, I invite any of our listeners who is interested to just reach out to the embassy. We are there. We are working on this. And we're looking for partners here in Canada to be to work together to improve issues that are so high on our agendas as democratic, liberal democracies and as countries that look for further development and enrichment and innovation and entrepreneurship. We believe in that.
Just a ton of insight there, Ambassador. Thank you. I'd like to spend our remaining moments talking a bit about the Canadian context, what you've observed since you were first appointed in August 2023, and ultimately what you'd like to convey to Canadian listeners. Let's start with your observations. At least since the attacks on October 7th, we've witnessed a spike in anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. What's your reaction to some of the things that we're seeing in parts of Canadian society and other Western countries for that matter? Is it an integration problem? Does our pluralism come with too few obligations? What in your mind must Western societies do to address these destructive ideologies?
I'm very concerned about those hate marches that are taking place in various parts of Canada and US and other parts of the world. I think that what most concerns me is this emotional expression of pure hate. And on top of that, the sense that Israel does not have a right to exist, and the sense that Jews have no rights in society as such. So Jews will not have a right to attend service at synagogue or universities or whatever. We are getting back in some ways to the times of the Nazis. And this is very serious. This needs to be addressed. And I know that the Canadian government is very concerned about that. And Ambassador Deborah Lyons works very hard throughout Canada to devise solutions. And I know that very recently MP Anthony Housefather will be joining the governmental effort. But there is a lot, in my mind, there is a lot that needs to be done and can be done in our bilateral context. And this is why, for example, we are connecting Yad Vashem, tutors and teachers with local partners here to be able to share our observations and our idea how the international definition of anti-Semitism can be implemented. It's non-binding. It was already recognized by the Canadian government, but it needs to be readdressed again and again and shared at lower levels, at provincial level, university levels. Private enterprises should be aware what anti-Semitism constitutes and how to make sure that it doesn't happen on their premises. So I'm very concerned about that. I'm also very, on the other end, very encouraged by the sense of support and solidarity that I hear from so many Canadians throughout this ordeal, this war. From the first day on, hundreds, if not thousands, of Canadians on a regular basis show their support, show their solidarity with Israel, and that's extremely important. It's very heartwarming. Both of our countries are liberal democracies, and we share that those values of life over hate, over annihilation of those horrible terminologies. We want to get away from that. We want to build societies that are plural. When I sent out greetings for Ramadan just now and for the Eid al-Fitr, I do that because I have friends in the Muslim world, in Israel, and I don't think that it is anything special. They reach out to me and they would send greetings for Rosh Hashanah, for Jewish New Year and all of that, because this is part of our life. And so our listeners should also know that in Israel, with Sharia law courts, which are operating to make it easier for Muslim families to resolve disputes in their families, and the fact that Muslim Arabs are not enlisted into the military because they may bring that may bring them into conflict, we have been able to devise a society that is extremely tolerant, very colorful, very pluralist. And I think it's important because this is what every country would like to have. So when you mentioned immigration and integration, perhaps, I think that the sky is the limit. There is a lot that can be done. It is enriching. It is important. It is helpful. It is vital. It is. It can be a growth motor for a country. But I think it's important also to stress those values of tolerance and acceptance and respect and to fight hate.
Well said. If I can put a penultimate question to you, Ambassador, support for Israel has been a longstanding subject of political consensus in Canada. One gets the sense, however, in recent months that it's increasingly polarizing. What's your role as ambassador to push back against those trends and contribute to a restoration of Canada's political consensus in favor of Israel and its right to exist and to defend itself?
Several things. One is very directly, I reach out to everybody in the political scene, because I think it's important for us to maintain a dialogue. If we disagree, let's talk about that. So get the emotional aspect out of it as much as possible and try to discuss the issue. We are also working through our what we call public diplomacy to reach out to communities that are different, that are perhaps have less natural inclination to reach out, to be connected to Israel, to minorities, to any part of society, to share with them our ideas about what Israel can mean for Canada. So for some, it would be a cultural issue. For others, it would be a business issue. And I think that this effort for us is a continuing effort that we need to continue. This is part of our mission. For me, definitely, personally, it is extremely important to reach out to all groups in society and to make sure that they know what we stand for. I think that's important. I think that's the most actual and effective effort that we can do to bridge those gaps that may exist between our two countries.
Final question. What would you like to convey to our Canadian listeners about the attacks of October 7th, the airstrikes over the weekend, Israel's efforts to defend itself, and more generally, its efforts to establish peace in the region? What might they be missing if they're relying solely on certain media outlets or public voices for their information about Israel and the Jewish people?
So I'll tell you a little story. I visited a Gulf country in the past where at that time we didn't have diplomatic relations. And I met with a high-level official there. And of course, he knew who I was, and he told me, you know, he shared with me. He said, "Listen, Ido, you know, I realized." First, he asked me, "Why do you need such strong military? You know, we are actually friends, even if we don't have formal relations." And I said, "Well, you're right, but we feel that that's important for our posture." And then he said something that surprised me very much. He said, first of all, he told me he downloaded this book, Israel Startup Nation, which was just nice. But what really surprised me, he said, "I saw a picture of Israeli F-16 jet, you know, fighter jets flying over Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland." And he said, "I looked at that picture and then I realized that in your psyche, you need to have that kind of force so that whatever happened in the past, this effort to annihilate the Jewish people, will never happen again." And he said to me, "I understand that. You," he told me, "have to understand that we feel that it is too much." Okay, point taken. But this for me was a symbol that he understands one of the core issues for us in terms of defending ourselves, this need to have this forceful posture, but also a strong military. And as we see, we saw this weekend, we need that. It's not just a posture. But I take his point that to some, it may seem as if we are over strengthening ourselves and not opening ourselves to have friendship relations with other countries. Since that time, a lot has changed. We have managed to sign the Abraham Accords agreements, and we are in the process of reaching out to many more countries. And I visited also other countries who believe in Israel, who believe in Israel's existence, of course, and also believe that the bilateral relations with Israel will be beneficial for them. And so my message is that sometimes we have to scratch the surface a little bit more. We have to understand what it really is about. Are we responding to hate? Are we responding to actual facts? Are we actually focusing on being a part of something fruitful and constructive, or are we part of something that may be destructive? This is the question that we have to ask ourselves. We have to choose. This is a difficult time, and all of us have to make difficult choices, but we need to make a choice. We cannot just go along with the crowd and say, well, you know, maybe tomorrow I'll change my mind. No, we have to make our minds today. We have to have our moral compass in place, in shape, because what is happening now in many parts, especially in the Middle East, is wrong. This sort of hate and the strive to annihilate a state, a people, is wrong and should be called out as such.
That's a good way to end the conversation. Ido Amoid, Israel's ambassador to Canada, thank you so much for joining us at Hub Dialogues.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Hub Dialogues, brought to you by Hub Canada Media. Visit www.thehub.ca for daily analysis and insights into the big issues and ideas driving the public conversation. Thehub.ca gives you access to our original news reporting and the thinking of the Hub's best writers, including Sean Spear. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you will receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was, along with all kinds of other terrific benefits. The host of today's program was Sean Spear, the Hub's editor-at-large. This episode was produced by Amal Atar Guzman. The Hub's audio producers are Alex Glutch and David Matta.